Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Today, on Hercules and the Planetary Powers, we have scholars from the edge of time, their new show of swords and planets. Let's welcome Nicholas Dyack and Michelle Brittany. Greetings, Nicholas and Michelle. How are you?
Greetings, Hercules. Doing very well, and yourself?
I'm doing well also. We had a internet blackout yesterday and today. So we just got the computer up and running just in time for the show.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, we're happy to hear that. We have some exciting discussion planned for this evening. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
Hello, sir.
So are you going first? Hey, Nick, how you doing?
You're doing okay. Just, you know, checking in. I'm glad things are going better for you. I'm happy that the internet's back on.
Yes, that happened suddenly and unexpectedly after yesterday's show. The internet went off. The television went off. So it's been a very adventurous time here in the Northeast.
It wasn't like 3 or 4 days ago. We were outside at night, just kind of chilling on our balcony. It was like 9 o'clock, and the power went out for a couple city blocks.
Ooh.
For about 2 hours. It's kind of eerie, you know, walking around, you know, the apartment complex, nothing but moonlight. That was cool. Moonlight's cool, but, you know, just like, you know, no more power. What are we going to do? Well, light the candles and time to talk spooky stories.
And that's your field of expertise, so that's a great thing.
So we're here to continue our sword and planet journey by going, I guess, back to the one that started it all, but in filmic format, talking about the John Carter adaptation of
Awesome.
Princess of Mars. So real quick, I do got a plot summation here, but just to kind of lay this down a bit, this is the first time Michelle and I had watched John Carter, and it was awkward for me because I'm going to be reading excerpts from my book, The New Peplum, which talks about John Carter. So, Nick, how could you have a book out that talks about John Carter and you haven't, you know, actually seen the film until now? Well, that's the power of BSing your way through things. But to be fair, a different scholar wrote that essay. I just edited it, and it's a dang good essay. So we'll talk about – and the other caveat is I read a lot of John Carter comics, and I've read a lot of successor stories, you know, like Lynn Carter knockoffs and Michael Resnick knockoffs, but actually have not read the original Princess of Mars. So we're going to be kind of approaching this film as the film. So that's kind of the
awesome
preface for this.
Well, thank you for the preface. It frames it perfectly.
Yes, Hercules, by the way, have you actually read A Princess of Mars?
Yes, I used to have the entire set of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars books in hardcover. And I read them, but I read them a long time ago. I tried to reread them a few years ago after I finished the Lynn Carter's Thongor series, and I just couldn't. I guess I had outgrown Burroughs. The same thing happened when I tried to read Tolkien a few years prior to that. I just couldn't get into it anymore, even though I loved the book series when I first discovered it and for many years afterwards. So the same thing happened with John Carter.
And, you know, I think that's one of the things we'll wind up talking about here in a few is, you know, both Tolkien and Burroughs, you know, these are progenitor stories. You know, a lot of stories and films came out after these that heavily borrowed and, you know, it set the standard for genre conventions, tropes and stuff. So, you know, as Michelle and I were watching John Carter, we're like, we've seen this before. I mean, we hadn't seen this before, but we might as well have seen it before. We've seen, you know, this is Star Wars right here. This is Flash Gordon right here. This is Planet of the Apes right here. So, and I can see that when other stories have came after and done things better, it's kind of, sometimes it's hard to go back to the ur-text. This is certainly an ur-text, although this is a filmic adaptation of said ur-text. All right. So, what's the plot of Carter, for those who don't know? So Barsoom, which is Mars, is in a state of civil war. It's Helium versus Zodanga, and everyone against the four-armed Tharks. The leader of Zodanga, Sabthon, is in cahoots with the Therms and has plans to take over Barsoom. But it involves marrying Deja Thoris, the daughter of the leader of Helium. She's, of course, very opposed to this idea. But on Earth, John Carter, he's a former Civil War soldier from Virginia. He's out prospecting in Arizona. After being pursued by a general who wants him back in the army and encountering some Apaches, Carter finds himself in a mysterious cave, kills a wayward Thern, takes his medallion, and is astral projected, carbon copied to Mars, a.k.a. Barsoom. There he discovers he now has great strength, agility, and jumping skills due to his bones in the Martian gravity.
His bone density.
His bone density.
Mm-hmm.
He is captured by the Tharks. But at night, there's a battle in airships between Helium and Zodanga. Carter intercedes and rescues Deja Thoris, who says she can get him back home to Earth. She really can't. Regardless, and Wula, a puppy alien, all party and band together and set across Mars. Deja is eventually forced to give herself up to Sabthon, and John Carter has a change of heart and will stay on Barsoom and help things out. He tries to enlist the help of the Tharks, which initially fails, and he's put through the arena, but he winds up kicking butt there. He eventually leads the Tharks on a big quest to stop the wedding of Deja Thoris and Sabthon and the scheming Therns, and he is victorious. He went via Deja, but he is transported back to Earth by an evil Thern. Back on Earth, Carter spends his years trying to get back to Barsoom. He does. So that's the very condensed version of the movie, which
yes.
in turn is a very condensed version of the book, I imagine. So
yes,
let's talk about John Carter. So it's a Sword and Planet story, and my interest in it is that it's what I call a neo-peplum story, or movie. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've talked about that before. You know, neo-peplum are the various Grecian, Roman-type media texts, be it film, television, video games, comics, that came out after the 90s. That one of the things that they do is they help expand the genre boundaries. And in the essay in my book, The New Peplum, by Dr. Johnson, he has an essay called Adapted to New Spaces, Sword and Planets in the Neo-Peplum. He kind of brings up the old Italian peplums, like, well, yeah, you have these Grecian Roman stories, but you also have these kind of genre blending ones. You know, you have like Hercules versus a black pirate and Hercules versus the Moon Men. And then you kind of lasso in these Zorro stories and these swashbuckling stories and these Viking stories. So, you know, where does, you know, the peplum genre start and end, and when do these other genres start and end? And one of his kind of theses is, well, you have these Sword and Planet stories, and they're basically adjacent to and extensions of the peplum genre. It's just more sci-fi-y. And I agree wholeheartedly with that. If you watch John Carter, it very much looks like a peplum film with a high budget set on another planet.
Yeah, I would agree with that, particularly like with the costuming. A lot of the costumes are very in keeping with early peplum films, not as much clothing. You're on Mars where it's a more desert, warm climate.
Which also looks like antiquities, like being in Egypt or something.
Yes. Yeah, and like the Thorks, they're kind of this militant group, four-armed. Did they have four legs?
Yeah, they have four arms and two legs.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and they're very kind of like battle-ready type of characters. And then you have
Well, they're
Carter.
Very much like the barbarians you would see in the different European campaigns of like Romans fighting barbarians. I would think of them as barbarians almost.
Yeah, definitely. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you actually kind of have like three classes of looking people. It seems like what was his name?
You're the one that's got Wikipedia up there.
I know, I do, but I'm trying to remember the cute guy.
Kantos Khan, played by James Purefoy.
No, I was actually thinking about, I'm sorry, guys. I'm just looking for his name. Oh, he was the main character. Oh, Saab Thawne. You know, he partners with the Therons. And so, Therons. The Therons. So he seems to have, the best technology. So they're, the most advanced. And then you've got the Helium group, which are advanced, but they're not at the same level because they're still trying to figure it out because they've got the science aspect. And then you have the barbarians. So
another kind of aspect of this film that kind of puts it in peplum territory is that it's a very homework film. It has kind of parallels to The Odyssey. And, The Odyssey, he's married, he's sent off to war, and he's trying to get back to his wife. Well, John Carter, he's trying to get back to two homes in this. His first home's back on Earth. But then later, when he gets back to Earth, he wants to get back to Mars, where his new wife is waiting for him. And, of course, battles everywhere. So it's very homework in that regard. But also, when he's in the Thark arena and he has to fight the blind white ape, well, that's basically a Cyclops, of the Iliad. So you've got kind of a reimagining of a mythological creature as, a giant arena ape.
Yeah, the arena was very, ruins-like. It really does look like a Colosseum.
Yeah, you can't – I think that's one of the things. You can't have a peplum film without having some form of an arena somewhere because, you have to have your strong man, be able to show off, his physical prowess. He's got to break chains. He's got to free slaves. He's got to fight lions. He's got to sword fight other folks. I mean, we've seen this from, Gladiator to, the ending of, we watched, a couple months ago, Ursus in the Valley of the Lions, that mm-hmm. ends in an arena. So, the arena is kind of that staple of the peplum genre, and here it is. You got this big old arena, which in turn made me think of the arena in Star Wars Episode II, where Anakin, Obi-Wan, and Padme, they're in this ruins-like arena, chained up. There's alien monsters running around that they got to fight. And of course,
that's right, because there's all the columns in there, yeah. And they use that to their advantage. I forgot about that.
But of course, I want to say that that George Lucas has been pretty overt that, his films leverage a lot of the media he grew up with, which includes Burroughs, Flash Gordon, Kira Kurosawa films, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So, when we were watching John Carter, there were so many scenes of this film. It's like, this looks like Star Wars from 10 years earlier. The various airship racing sequences looked exactly like pod racing sequences in Episode 1.
And they even had, the same sound effects.
Yeah.
We were talking about that, how I was, thinking it sounded so familiar, and then you were saying it was from Episode 1.
Yeah.
I would also say, kind of going to the homework ideology or structure of this film, there's also the hero's journey. And unlike Hercules, which I feel is always kind of a consistent, we get growth through John Carter because he doesn't want to be part of any sort of fight. He wants to be on his own. He was a Confederate soldier. The Union colonel in Arizona is trying to get him to fight on the Union side, and he's like, no, I don't want to have anything to do with it. He's also trying to get over the fact that his wife and daughter had been killed during the war, during the Civil War. And so there's a lot of growth by John Carter through the film.
The thing is, I could see the growth, but one of the things that's been described to me, and I wish I can attribute this to someone, but I can't, just because over the years, Michelle and I, we've been on a lot of, she's ran a lot of sword and planet, sword and sorcery panels at Comic Cons. So someone there has said this. But I wish I remember who, but they said, in the John Carter stories, it's not John Carter that changes, it's the world around him that changes. And I always thought that was kind of an interesting take. Now, I'm guessing, that extends past, you know, Princess of Mars to all the other books that come after it, where you have, I mean, I could kind of see where that's going. You got a guy from Earth that's on a different planet. Here's this, you know, exotic person that has, you know, he's powerful, he can jump, he commands a lot of stuff. So I could kind of see how the world would change to suit him rather than him change to suit this world.
And we definitely see that in the film. Like, you know, the Tharks don't want to go to war. They have no interest in.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, let those people have their civil war. We don't care. John Carter convinces them through the arena fight, and even to the point where various people salute others, which is a John Carterism, I'm going to say.
Which he brought from his military. It's another thing that he brought. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do see that there is some changes, albeit more personal or psychological, for John Carter in this film that I think give a little bit of that growth versus what we've seen in probably other things.
And that's another Star Wars scene there where, you know, Carter goes to the Tharks, hey, I need you to fight with me against everyone else. I mean, we see that trope in a lot of films, but, you know, I think of Star Wars Episode One where they go to the Gundans in the swamp and say, hey, you got to come fight, you know, the Trade Federation. Yeah, we don't want to do that. So I do want to read a little bit from my book, The New Peplum, because it says things a little bit more succinct than I ever could, and that's kind of the importance of, you know, literature here. One of the things that was talking about is, let me find the page. Hold on, give me a second here. I'm pulling Michelle. Where is it? Where is it?
Wow, twice it is. You and me. We don't have more hall passes.
We don't. It talks about the act of melodrama that's in the original peplum that is replicated in these films. Let's talk about Daft Punk, which is one of your. There we go. Okay, so we're talking about melodrama here, and it's saying the gist of it is you know the old not just sword and sandal films, but the historic epics as well, are extremely melodramatic. You got these grandiose films with grandiose sets and grandiose set pieces. So, of course, you have to have, you know, over-the-top acting to go with it. But the thing is the sword and sandal films are low budget. So how do you get that grandioseness? But, you know, you're still melodramatic, so you kind of come off a little, huh, what's this? And that sort of happens in the Neil Peplum Sword and Planet films as well. It's just that, you know, the difference is their budget's bigger. So, quote, this is from Johnson, page 29, Adapting to New Spaces. Sword and Planet films are florid, colorful, and spectacular, using a visual scale that is at once epic, but also a twist on the conventions therein. Though Peplum films have a sense of scale, they have been positioned as a box office ploy in spectacular bad taste. Frank Burke makes note of them using papier-mâché boulders, ridiculous monsters, and suggests low costs, whereas John Carter, Tron Legacy, and Jupiter Ascending have vast budgets, enabling decent production values. Each film arguably looks professional in comparison to earlier Pepla, but there are numerous aspects surrounding these films that do impart a sense of melodrama, spectacular cartoon-like style, and occasionally bad taste. John Carter offers an eclectic mix of characters that, perhaps due to its basis as a family film from Disney, often seems cartoon-like in style. Carter's gravity-defying leaps and strength, the dog-like CG animated character Lula, and the overwrought dialogue that permeates throughout, plus the romance between Carter and Princess Deja, is especially redolent of Peplum's antecedent style. Moreover, much of the dramatic development of the film between the heroes and villains is overtly elaborate to the point of being difficult to follow, creating a sense of spectorial disbelief at how bad the film is, to become amusing, which might position spectators to become more visually biased and less interested in story and characters. The visual spectacle, both in terms of action and locations, plays out huge, melodramatically based scale to the base emotional core of audiences via visceral thrills, rather than character engagement. In consequence, Carter operates on a Virginius cut and thrusts modus operandi moving between high spectacle and hijinks, from Carter and Princess Deja swooning against or swinging into a backdrop of masked aliens, explosions, and or other extraordinary sensational action to light comedy, sometimes all at once. And I think that's something you also see in a lot of Peplum back then, that even though they weren't funny, you would get various dubs of them, various cuts, various edits of them that, this is kind of my opinion here, getting away from Johnson, that lend well to, say, being riffed on Mystery Science Theater 3000, where Mike and or Joel and the robots are able to see through, you know, some of, you know, these low-high production values to see a sense of comedy. I mean, we were watching, you know, Hercules and the Mongols, what, 2-3 months ago, you know, that sequence where, you know, he picks up a tree and swings it around. And, of course, you know, the scene is supposed to be, you know, he's lifted up this tree and he's using it as a club. But at the same time, you're like, well, one, it's a hollow tree. Two, it's very unwieldy and the people are just barely getting jabbed and falling off their horses. So it's like all at once, like, it's high spectacle. We see where it's going, but it is live action cartoony in a way.
Which is interesting because of the fact that Andrew Stanton, who is the director of this film, had his background animated films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did Finding Nemo in 2003, and then he did WALL-E in 2008. So it's interesting that the pickup of the kind of lighthearted, the all ages, you know, structure of this film, and that definitely comes through with, you know, his inexperience to do live action adventure type film. You know, I think he was trying for, and I think he said in an interview that, you know, he wasn't trying to go for an all-ages film, and that what he wanted was one that was going to be more adult-oriented, you know, towards a more adult audience, and a film that was based on the novels, rather than something that was a bit more, I don't know, cartoony.
Yeah, but I guess my only concern is that, again, I haven't read the books, but I've read so many rip-offs of the books.
Mm-hmm.
They're fun. They're pulpy. You know, the Lynn Carter stuff, the Resnick stuff, even the Joe Lansdale stuff. I mean, even Joe, I love Joe Lansdale's writing, but, you know, even he mimics the Sword and Planet style in his stuff. They all have these really outlandish tropes of, you know, how do you get someone from Earth to another planet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, astral projection or being on the Titanic and drowning. That happens in a Joe Lansdale one. That it's hard to take, outsider looking in, even as a fan of the genre, you have to really suspend your disbelief and you have to take a lot of this, not necessarily for a grain of salt, but just you just have to accept that this is over the top, really implausible. And I think that kind of lends to, well, do you take it, do you legitimately try to take that super seriously in a film, or do you just gloss over it, or do you kind of embrace the absurdity of it? And if you do, that maybe that leads down to kind of the more cartoonish route. Look, you're in a cave and you pick up a medallion, you're astral projected over here. Well, aren't bugs eating your body? Aren't other prospectors going to find you? No, you just have to kind of, if you have to accept all that, you're going to have to accept a lot of other, I think, silliness.
Yeah, I think, for example, the cave.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, he's in the cave for, what are we going to say, like maybe 20 years or something?
Yeah.
I don't know how long he's supposed to be in the cave.
Enough to turn the other guy to a skeleton.
Yeah, so we're probably at least 20 years.
It's 20, but it's still a length of time.
Yeah. But the fact is that the Native Americans know where that cave is.
Yeah.
So you think that at some point they might go and, I don't know, take a look at the cave, because the cave was like, I think it was called like Spider Cave.
Well,
they were
afraid of it and they ran away, but that's true. But still, at some point, hey, there's a cave. Let's go check it out.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you know, the thing is, you can balance, you know, comedy and, I mean, to me, embracing the absurd and having a little bit of comedy works with things like Star Wars. Star Wars, I mean, again, Star Wars is heavily indebted to John Carter. I mean, visually, story-wise, character-wise, all done better. I mean, Princess Leia is Deja Thoris. But while Deja Thoris in the text is a damsel in distress, this book, in the movie, she's not so much a damsel in distress, but she's not exactly quite a hold her own character either. But then you have Princess Leia, who's like, you know, I'm going to rescue you people because you can't even rescue yourselves, you know, that sort of thing. So
there is a small part when they're, when John Carter and her are first fighting against Savathun, that, you know, he steps up,
yeah,
and he says, get behind me, I'll save you. And then, you know, he fights a few, and then she comes forward and she fights a lot more of the characters, and he says, oh, maybe I should stand behind you. So there's some of that light humor that tries to alleviate maybe, and maybe kind of like make a joke of itself.
So on the subject of ladies and dudes,
yeah,
I think we should talk about bodies, because inherently Peplum Films is all about body spectacle, especially the male body spectacle. And one of the things about John Carter, and this also talked about in Johnson's essay, is John Carter does not have a peplum body. And in fact, most neo-peplum films, and even the Sword and Planet films, that you don't have a bodybuilder. You don't have a Steve Reeves type person in these roles. And in fact, if I may, I'll extend that to a bigger sphere, is we don't have that many bodybuilders, period, in actor roles. You have a handful. You have like The Rock, for instance. But for every Rock, you have, you know, more, you
there's
know.
There's 100 other.
Yeah. I mean, there's
actors.
They're fit people, obviously.
Yeah.
They're handsome. They're attractive people. They definitely got a six pack, which I don't have. But you don't have a lot of Rocks, and what, you know, you don't have,
you, there.
You don't have, I mean, even Arnold Schwarzenegger from the 80s, you know, cooled off that type of, you know, film to do more, you know, family oriented fare, you know, even like the Terminator films he does now downplay his physicality. But going back to John Carter, he doesn't have a peplum body, but his body operates like a peplum body. So if you think about a character like Hercules or another mythological character, well, where do they get their strength? You know, is it a divine intervention from the gods to bless him with the strength?
Mm-hmm.
Is it he actually has been training super hard for, you know, arena-torial-like games all his life and it's training? No, Carter is like an accidental peplum hero by sheer virtue of this being him and going to another planet that responds to his bone structure differently and just being kind of a moderately handsome, I'm going to put that in quotes because I don't think he's that handsome, guy. He becomes a peplum hero. He's, instead of a bodybuilder's body, he has this kind of a normal, you know, present-day Hollywood man body.
Yeah, he's kind of the everyman type of body type. And if anything, when you see a picture of him not as John Carter, he's, you know, is not got the kind of presence that you would think a Sword and Planet type hero would have. And in fact, he's a reluctant hero, or maybe even an anti-hero, because he doesn't want to be one.
Now, here's the funny thing about the John Carter body versus the Taylor Kitsch body. I'm assuming, going back to seeing, like, the cover art of the original Princess of Mars, that original Edgar Rice Burroughs stories doesn't upplay the body either. But you have, decades later, the Frank Frazetta renditions of John Carter. And guess what? That John Carter is ripped. That is a peplum body John Carter. So, you know, it's the literary John Carter was redefined as a peplum bodybuilding type hero via cover art done by the likes of Frenzetta and Boris Vallejo. And of others of a similar ilk. It was those artists of the 70s that turned him into, you know, 10, 15 years after the peplum craze, mm-hmm. into Sword and Planet hero, which, of course, you would see in other Sword and Planet, He-Man. You know, John Carter is obviously a template for He-Man, and He-Man is obviously, you know, a little bit of an homage to Frazetta.
And it's interesting that you bring up Frazetta, because, you know, that kind of harkens back to when they were trying to put out a John Carter film. Mm-hmm. And I think it was back in 2004, Robert Rodriguez had signed on to direct the film, John Carter of Mars.
He also was going to give us a Red Sonja, but that didn't happen either.
That didn't happen either. But he had planned to hire Frank Frazetta to be the designer of the film. And then because Rodriguez had actually stepped away with Sin City, and he defended Frank Miller as a co-director, mm-hmm. and left, Rodriguez was not able to stay and direct this film.
Oh, man, a Frazetta-based John Carter adaptation would be awesome, but mm-hmm. if done right, because, you know, he also helped along with Fire and Ice by Ralph Bashky, mm-hmm. and I like Fire and Ice, but it's not exactly, you know, high mm-hmm. cinema either, but in again, I like Ralph Bashky, but, you know, there's leagues difference between Ralph Bashky and some of the stuff that Rodriguez was cranking out.
Yeah, and so it sounds like after Rodriguez left, John Favreau actually was working with Mark Fergus, and they wanted to be more faithful to the Burroughs novels. And so for a while, Favreau was going to direct the film. And then he was going to use practical effects, and he was going to use Planet of the Apes as his inspiration. But I guess in 2006, Paramount, who had the rights to do the film, decided not to renew. And so they wanted to focus on the Star Trek franchise.
Which is influenced by Burroughs.
Yeah. And so Favreau and Fergus went on to do Marvel Studios' Iron Man.
And later on, Mandalorian, which is a spaghetti Western Sword and Planet story.
Yep. When Andrew Stanton comes into the picture, because he pitched really heavy to take to do this film. And so it's kind of interesting, kind of wrapping back down back to Frank Frazetta, is that both he and I think Jim Morris, who was the executive producer for the film, they both wanted to have a unique look to the film, and they felt that Frazetta's illustrations were dated. So that's why they moved away from,
I don't know,
Frazetta.
Okay. This is opinion piece here. Looking at Frank Frazetta art versus looking at the end product of John Carter here,
mm-hmm.
I'd still take the Frazetta art, because that 60s, 70s psychedelic sci-fi style was very distinctive, and it's not something you see in a lot of films. Well, on the other hand, let's just be honest. John Carter, the film, looked like Star Wars. I'm sorry, that's Tatooine. They're on Tatooine this entire film. That's, if anything, okay, this is a good segue to what I want to talk about in a second, is, you know, the film does lack a character. Despite slavish set pieces, airships, and whatever, the actual setting of Barsoom is pretty drab. So what do you do in that sort of situation? Well, you have really darn good actors. And one of the things that I was on a podcast last year, Fanbase Press's podcast, talking about Gladiator, and one of the things I brought up is a good peplum film is supported by good peplum actors. Because, you know, if you think back to the Italian pepla, these actors appeared in every single peplum film. You'd pick out one person, and they would actually be in a lot of peplum, Eurospy, spaghetti westerns, you know, you had your stock character, not character, actors that just thrived in the Italian genre system there. And so, you know, in Gladiator, you know, your main characters are not peplum stars. Up to that point, Russell Crowe hadn't done any peplum. Joaquin Phoenix hadn't done any peplum. But you were supported by a great cast that were peplum. You had Oliver Reed, who'd done his fair share of peplum. You had, I had a giant list a year ago for us. You had all these classic actors who had done, you know, traditional peplum or kind of newer, you know, 70s and 80s peplum. I mean,
Jacobine. You had Richard Harris.
Richard Harris had done stuff.
Yep.
Ralph Moeller, I mean, come on, Ralph Moeller was Hercules in the 90s, and, you know, also a great bodybuilding type of actor as well, plus he was in the Nominee music video. So glad
Ralph Moeller played,
you know,
Hercules? I didn't know that. I know he played Conan.
I'm sorry, I messed that one up. But, yeah, he was Conan in the TV series in the 90s. But Ralph Moeller, awesome. Sword and sorcery / peplum actor. So that's what helped Gladiator is, you know, your main stars didn't have, you know, the antiquity experience, but the supporting cast did. And so does that hold true with John Carter? And I said, hey, Michelle, why don't you take a look at the cast who was in peplum films? And she came back with a literal papyrus scroll of so many.
Yeah, and not only were they have ties to either gladiator-type films, they had ties to sword and sorcery, sword sandals, sword and planet, like Karian Hines, who played the Jeddak of Helium. He had been King Lot in Excalibur. He was the Knight Templar in Ivanhoe. He was Julius Caesar in the series Rome. He was Mance Rayder in Game of Thrones. He was King Austin in Jason and the Argonauts. And Dominic West, who played Sab Thon, who was the Jeddak of the Zodanga. He was the Spartan politician Theon in 300. He was General Valerius in Centurion. He actually was up for the role of Manus that actually Hines had actually taken. James Purefoy, who was Cantos Khan. He was kind of the right-hand man to the Karian Hines character. He was Solomon Kane. He was Marshall in Ironclad, which was a
wow.
Kind of, you know, more of a Knights Templar type film. Also from the Rome series, he was Mark Antony. He was King Lot in Camelot, which is, you know, kind of the whole Excalibur universe. And he was King Edward in A Knight's Tale.
Are we talking about James Purefoy?
Yeah.
Yeah, before we go any further, that guy was a scene stealer in John Carter. He's like, he only has two scenes. I'm like, he's the most interesting person in this film.
Yeah.
Anyway, keep going.
Polly Walker, who was the merciless Thark against Sola, she was also from the Rome series. She was Atia of Julie. William Dafoe, who I didn't realize was in the movie, he played the Jeddak of the Tharks, and he was Sola's father. Of course, he was Jesus from The Last Temptation of Christ. He's been in a ton of films. He's, you know, such an amazing presence. And then he's going to be in a film called Northmen that was delayed. It's a Viking film, but he is Heimar the Fool. And then one other fellow, he was a Zodangan general, and that was Art Mullick, who's been in a shitload of films. And he was Olympus in the 1999 Cleopatra miniseries that I have a film of. So you had an incredible supporting cast that have all been in the sword and sword and whatever type film.
So, I like to call it sword and something.
Sword and something. So you have a boatload of people with experience to make this. And honestly, I mean, they also kind of had body types that fit with the roles that they had.
If anything, the film in the case of James Purefoy, they underutilized him. And I get that, it's kind of inescapable. This is a John Carter story, dang it. It says John Carter on the poster, which, as a side note, is probably the reason why this movie failed miserably at the box office.
We can talk about that a little bit, too.
But, you know, this is supposed to be a John Carter film. This is about the world around John Carter. This is his story, dang it. And everyone else is second, third, fourth, third. I get that. But, you know, it's just few moments of, like, you know, James Purefoy's character saying, you know, take me hostage, huh? What? You know, that help elevate it. I just wish there were more of them. Because when the movie has a chance to use those characters, it helps not to. Like the example, the character of Sola, you know, more often times than not, John Carter will just abandon being around her to do something else. And that's kind of a shame.
It is, and like there's one scene where they talk and he kind of inspires her because she's kind of thinking that she's just going to, I guess, kind of end it, you know, and figure that she is a blemish to the Thorks. I mean, she's marked all over her body as, you know, punishment. She has no more room on her body, and so the next mistake is her death. And yet she's one of the most fascinating characters in the film. And Nick is really right, the fact that, you know, the more interesting characters are the secondary, the second-tier characters that we just don't get enough of.
I think what kind of makes that more of a crime is, at the end of the day, do I buy Taylor Kitsch as John Carter? And, you know, other people who are more versed with the Edgar Rice Burroughs stories and comics and literature and adaptations would have a different answer. And I'm just going cinematically that I just don't think he's that interesting. At the end of the day, he's just not an interesting-looking person, not an interesting-looking actor that had someone, and I couldn't tell you who would be better fit, but another better fit, I would say, than the sacrifices made on the supporting cast to booster him would have been worth it, but the sacrifices aren't worth it. At the end of the day, he's just kind of bland. He looks like Willy Wonka era Johnny Depp down a tier.
Well, and I think that if you had had a stronger actor in the role who could carry it more completely, then the other characters could have been elevated and they could have shared in the spotlight, so to speak, without actually kind of looking like they're stealing the scene. When Nick and I were talking offline, I actually thought of Josh Harnett as being a good John Carter, particularly from his work with Penny Dreadful and some of the storyline that kind of goes to the Wild West. I think that he would have been, I think he could have been a good John Carter. And he would have had the chops to carry the film and yet move aside to allow and give room for the other characters to also shine. I just feel like we didn't even get a lot of the villain.
You know what I would suggest instead? If you're looking for it's not a Sword and Planet film, but it does take place on another planet that has kind of a reluctant hero in quotes that just doesn't want to get involved and that has a great casting, watch Pitch Black with Vin Diesel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of ballpark similar film. You got this, you know, desert world. This one's at night, but there's monsters everywhere. You know, there's no Antiquity or Sword and Planet stuff there, but there you have an instance of the actor fits the role and the role is interesting. The cast is small, but the cast supports. The cast has Carl Urban in it, right? He's in the second
one.
Oh, that's right. But, you know, he's a
necromonger, yeah.
Yeah, you have Rodham Mitchell, who did a brilliant job as the captain and being tormented by her decision to, you know, jettison, you know, pods of people as a way of saving the few that are end up on the planet, which made for a much more interesting film and set up for the entire film, and there's a reason why it's a really good one. So, say, you had mentioned, Nick, something about the kind of 70s vibe with Franzetta. So I thought that, was actually kind of interesting because Andrew Staton, you know, having the background with Pixar, for whatever reason, he also had a lot of clout with regards to how the film was marketed.
Or
lack thereof. So one of the things he did is he ignored the criticism to use a Led Zeppelin song called Cashmere in apparently the trailer. Now, I don't think I've seen the trailer.
But I know the song, though, and I
do too.
Sweeping Martian dunes of da-da-da, da-da-da.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that he didn't want to go the Franzetta route, but he went with Cashmere. He also apparently chose a billboard imagery that failed to basically resonate with the intended audience. And the preview reel that he put together that was shown like at the various pop culture conventions really didn't get a strong reception because it really didn't kind of put the pieces together. And I know we haven't talked a ton about the story, but there's a real problem with like the pacing of the story and just kind of the buy-in of the audience. It isn't as tight as it could be.
I read from Johnson's paper kind of pointed out, like, mm-hmm. you have all these different tones. Now, how is the audience with the buy-in to what's going on?
Yeah. The other thing that I think hurt the film, and this was the film was originally titled John Carter of Mars, but Staton removed the of Mars to make it appeal to a more broader audience. Stating that the film was, quote, an origin story. It's about a guy becoming John Carter of Mars.
It's called, you know what? Okay, one, John Carter is like the blandest name you could ever use. It's like, what's that thriller film with, like, George Clooney? I think it was called, like, Michael Clayton. Like, what is that about? It's just a name. But mm-hmm. also you had, I think it was a Sylvester Stallone film that came out a couple years earlier, which was a remake of who's the guy who was in Jaws 4? And he was in Batman.
Are you talking about Michael Caine?
Yeah, Michael Caine, I think. Didn't he have, there was a movie called Get Carter.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, there was
Carter.
A British
yeah.
version, and then there was a remake decades later, I think, by Sylvester Stallone. I'm like, Get Carter? That's John Carter sounds like Get Carter. I mean, what can I say? It's the most uninteresting title, even the name John.
Well, and it I don't know. Hercules, I kind of figured that at least for some people to see the name John Carter, wouldn't they might think that it's an Edgar Rice Burroughs John Carter of Mars?
Yeah, I remember when all this was happening, what you're describing, and I was against the choice of John Carter as the name of the film because it doesn't tell you anything. The Asylum, I believe it was, made a Princess of Mars movie that was loosely based on Burroughs a little bit earlier than John Carter came out. I believe it had entered the public domain. I don't know if that contributed to their not naming it A Princess of Mars, but I think A Princess of Mars would have been a much better title for it. Or if they did something else with John Carter, like you and Nick were saying, John Carter of Mars, at least it would have drawn more attention. But John Carter was too bland, it told you absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I was even thinking if they had said something like, kind of like Bram Stoker's Dracula, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's film. Well, why didn't they say
right.
Edgar Rice Burroughs, John Carter of Mars or something? Just be really, you know, beat people over the head with, you know, to make it very clear. But I think you're right. I think that, you know, he didn't want the film associated with the Asylum film. But then there was also, I guess Disney also had a film called Mars Needs Mom.
Yeah, see, that's the, as I say now,
and that came out a year before.
See, Asylum films are a blink in the radar. In fact, if anything, asylum films now are more revered because they gave all those Sharknado films, so they're a bit more respected. You know, when Transformers was coming out, no one really batted an eye at the asylum films. So not to disparage Edgar Rice Burroughs, but general movie-going audience doesn't know who that is.
Yeah.
They, if anything, they might know who Tarzan is. It's because of Tarzan having, you know, decades of kind of pop culture currency, but not Barstoom stuff. And so, you know, if people are going to think Edgar Rice Burroughs, they'll think Tarzan first. And so, if anything, those excuses, if he's given those excuses, are bunk. The Mars Needs Moms one, I can believe, but even then, that's just kind of like, it seems like more of an excuse. I'm sorry, a movie called Mars Needs Moms, this automatically either, it just doesn't sound, it sounds like it's for 7-year-olds, which is fine if you've got kids.
Yeah.
But,
And even the poster is kind of like, well, you've got Rula there, which is a real cutie. So you're kind of thinking, well, okay, what this looks like it's going to be, you know, kind of an adventure kids film. I wanted to mention that Michael Sellers wrote a book called John Carter and the Gods of Hollywood. And he cites that there are many factors in the film's commercial failure. But he says that the film had tested actually well with audiences, but failed more because of marketing problems, which included not mentioning Mars, Barsoom, or Edgar Rice Burroughs on promotional posters, which meant that many fans of the Burroughs books were completely unaware of the film and its subject matter until after it bombed. So anyway, there we go. That was something that he brought up.
Those are good points.
Overall, I guess I know we're kind of coming up close to the end of the hour. I guess the final question that we should be asking ourselves is, do we actually like John Carter? Because I feel like we're disparaging it. And, okay, well, let's put it this way. Last month we talked about Ice Pirates. So, but here's the deal. I walked away with Ice Pirates feeling happy. I had fun. I had a good laugh. I ended John Carter like I'd watched a big epic, but not necessarily like I was fulfilled. Like, and I was talking to Michelle about this, you know, the feeling I have was after you get done watching the Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, at the end of it all, you felt like, man, I went on this big adventure and met a lot of people. I had an experience. And I feel like John Carter is one of those things that you just went on a big adventure. But I didn't meet a lot of people, and I didn't really have an experience. It's like taking a road trip, but not stopping and seeing the sights. Like, there was a promise there, and maybe I had a good time. I'm in the car, I'm jamming, I'm eating
and there's some humorous things about the trip.
Yeah.
But ultimately.
Yeah, ultimately unfulfilled. Especially, you know, it's one of those things that maybe if a sequel had came out, then I could continue my adventure. And I felt like I wanted this adventure. And I had an adventure, but I left away with empty calories.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I also felt that there was some definitely fun moments.
Woola!
I liked Woola. It kind of reminded me of the Neverending Story and the dog dragon.
The dog dragon.
I did feel like I missed, like, a larger story, the opportunity of a more epic story to be told. And that I'm actually bummed that the film didn't do better, because I feel like I could have gotten invested in this IP. I could have gotten invested in this world if there had been more. It's kind of like when, you know, you watch something and you're like, damn, I really wish it had done better so that way I could see more of this world, and it just didn't deliver what it could have if it had been in probably right hands, you know, directing and someone with more live action experience and things like maybe a John Tiernan, who was actually associated with this project in the 80s. You know, maybe that would have been quite the film if he had been, you know, directing it.
You know who should have directed it? He'd gone into the Han Solo film and touch it up. I think Ron Howard could have done a good John Carter film.
You know, actually, and it would have been something that could have actually introduced a younger audience to the Burroughs universe, and probably would have, you know, created a whole new generation of interest in those books.
Yeah. One of the things you both pointed out was that it was not like Star Wars, like Tatooine. That's because George Lucas borrowed heavily from the Mars books when he designed Tatooine. Even the those in the Banffs, it's pretty much the same word with an A added to it to describe the creatures that were there. So they weren't the same creature, but again, they were Banthas or Banffs that was used to describe it. So Lucas borrowed heavily from Mars, and you wouldn't know that unless you were an Egwyrus Burroughs fan.
You know, the funny thing is he wears his homages on his sleeve from Burroughs to Caracarasaw. The thing is, I hadn't read the Burroughs stuff, but I've read Lynn Carter's knockoffs. I've read the Jandar of Callisto books, and I like those. And so the funny thing is, as I'm watching this film, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's in Jandar of Callisto. Oh, wait, no, that's a knockoff. Because the Sarks are realized as insect people. You know, there's airships, and there's a damsel in distress. All the beats, I'm like, that's Lynn Carter. That's Lynn Carter. No, Nick, Lynn Carter's ripping off Edgar S. Burroughs. And, of course, everyone else is ripping off Edgar S. Burroughs, too.
Hey, real quick,
Unfortunately, we only have, like, 4 minutes left. I'd love for you guys to share your contact information, but this is definitely a to-be-continued. My wife and I did love the movie, John Carter. We too wished that it was better received because we would have liked to visit more, but it didn't happen.
Well, I'll go ahead and give my details. I have an Amazon page, an author page. You can find me there. I also have a professional webpage or Facebook as albertini.com. I haven't kept it completely up to date, so you know, don't go there at the moment. And then I've also written about mummies, Michelle's musings on mummies. I did want to mention that next month I hope people will come back and listen to us discuss Valerian.
That's right, another sci-fi space film that just flops like John Carter. I'm at nickdiak.com, N-I-C-K-D-I-A-K.com. From there, it's links to all my social media, my news, my Peplum news. I got links to all my Burroughs writing there because while I haven't read the Urtext, I have read many of the comics. And so I know John Carter from comic book adaptations. So I got quite a few views and analyses linked at my website. So that's where you can find me. I'm a pretty gregarious dude.
Thanks to both of you. It's always great to get in touch, and I learned a lot from all that you explained, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Awesome. We look forward to talking to you in October, and between now and then, you know, we wish you the very, very best, and wish everyone tuning in the very best.
You. And the same to all the people who listened today, whether you called in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself there, or whether you're going to join us later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing all of you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And in the fraction of a minute we have left, let me see what I can play. I'll play Golden Bough. Thanks again, Nick, and thanks again, Michelle. You're awesome. Have an awesome day.
Of her cries, Lady of Moon.